Okay, hope that's okay with you, Cheryl. Yes, Om Shanti Sachidananda, indeed. A happy Monday evening. I don't know where you are, but where I am, it is storming up a treat. My poor dog is shaking under the bed in the room next door. I've tried everything over the years we've spent together, and I can't get her to settle, so I just leave her now. Send her some. Ask angels to surround her. Okay, so before we commence with verse 13 of the Tao Te Ching, we're just going to have a short centering. And we're going to take a little time with that today. Just to really just see if we can move into the self. Our sense of being, let's see if we can gain a sense of being. So we're just going to close the eyes. And just sense into that place within us. And we're looking for the perceiver of any experiences that we might be having at the moment, whether those are thoughts arising or physical sensations arising. Who is it that perceives those, or who is the awareness? And maybe we don't even need to do that, we can just sort of sense into this I am presence that's always there. And we're just going to make an offering of our time together this evening. May it be for the benefit of everyone. May everyone be happy. May all beings be at peace. Okay. Okay. Yeah, so a couple of people in the room mentioning that they have a storm going on too, a bit of an electrical storm. So yeah, some exciting energy. I always think about it in a storm. So I'm going to read verse 13. We're on verse 13 of the Tao Te Ching. So I thought I would just read it through and then we'll go through it. This evening I am doing something a little bit different. I normally contemplate the verse and make lots of notes and think a lot about it. And instead, I've just kind of just contemplated it last night, contemplated this morning, and haven't really written any notes. But I did sort of mark some pages in other books that I thought might be helpful. So that's kind of it. So please bear with me. I'm not the most articulate person as my boyfriend Bill will gladly attest to. I often speak in half thoughts and then finish them off at the end, leaving people sort of confused for 90% of the time. So we'll see how it goes. But I just wanted to start with reading this particular verse. Let's see if you can sense into what these words are saying for you. Success is as dangerous as failure. Hope is as hollow as fear. What does it mean that success is as dangerous as failure? Whether you go up the ladder or down it, your position is shaky. When you stand with your 2 feet on the ground, you will always keep your balance. What does it mean that hope is as hollow as fear? Hope and fear are both phantoms that arise from thinking of the self, and that is with a small s. When we don't see the self as self, what do we have to fear? And again, those are small s's. So you could replace it with the ego or identity. When we don't see the identity as identity, what do we have to fear? In other words, when we are resting in the self with a big s, then we have nothing to fear. See the world as yourself. And again, it doesn't have a large s, but I'm sure I pretty sure that's what it is intending in this translation. See the world as yourself, have faith in the way things are, love the world as yourself, then you can care for all things. So I just had a few things I wanted to say. When I read this verse, I had completely forgotten it even existed. And it felt really out of place among the other verses, because to me, this verse is very much Advaita Vedanta. It's talking about being back in the self with a capital S, and, you know, resting in that place. And then when I thought about that, I thought, oh, how strange. The whole of the Tao Te Ching is really that. I mean, it's constantly telling you to come back to the self, although it uses, you know, this word Tao as sort of like pure consciousness, consciousness in its purest form, the supreme being, if you will. So I was kind of surprised that I really had forgotten that, or not been able to see that the two are very similar. The two teachings are very similar. And then because the word self runs throughout this verse, it sort of shocked me a little, because it doesn't often use the word self in the other verses that we've come across, and I don't believe it does later on. So just really interesting for me, and particularly at the moment, I'm really drawn to those teachings. It's very specific teachings, like Ramana Maharshi, teachings of Muji, some of Regina's teachings around Inner Ramana. I know she's teaching now the spiritual teachings of Ramana Maharshi on Wednesdays in her Guiding Light class or session. So I was really excited that a lot of this verse, this verse to me sort of speaks to those teachings. So I thought we'd just sort of go through them and break them down. So I'm just having a tea. Success is as dangerous as failure. And then it says, what does it mean that success is as dangerous as failure? Whether you go up the ladder or down it, your position is shaky. When you stand with your 2 feet on the ground, you will always keep your balance. So often when we, you know, and I just want to point out that every single word in the Tao Te Ching, there aren't many words in the whole text, so every word counts. So the choice of word counts, and there are several interpretations and translations, but I'm assuming that those who've been drawn to translate it have been selective as well with their words. So success is as dangerous as failure. So I think it's important to listen to this word, dangerous as failure. So often when we go through life, you know, we don't want failure. It seems obvious. And when we wish things for our friends and our loved ones, we would never wish them failure. We would always wish them success with all their endeavors. But here we're being told by the Tao Te Ching that success is as dangerous as failure. So we're thinking about this in context of a few other teachings. And essentially for me, what this says, if you were to, and I'm not a huge reader of the Bible, but it brought to mind this the verse, I think it's in Matthew, I'm not sure, but it talks about that it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven. And to me, it's the same as what it's saying here. Success is as dangerous as failure. So we often think that failure is what we want to avoid, and we want to bring success into our life. And that's very much the mind that wants to do that. It's made a value judgment, and the value is success has value and failure does not. Failure devalues our lives. But what the Tao teaches, and indeed what many teachings teach, and in the teaching from the Bible, is that whether we're wanting success or failure, they're the same. They're two sides of the same coin. They cannot exist without each other. So for all the successes that you wish for yourself and may be enjoying, at some point the pendulum will swing back. That's just the nature of existence, of human existence, of the human experience, that it's this duality. So wishing for success, or setting your heart on success, is as dangerous to a spiritual seeker as setting one's sights on failure. They're essentially the same. And dangerous because it takes you away from your true nature. You know, if you think about this experience we may have just had of when you're resting in the self or your being, there is no sense of needing to achieve. And similarly, there is no sense of failure. There's like a nothingness, an emptiness, and those two don't exist. It's only in sort of duality that those two come into existence. It's all a mindset, yeah. So wishing for success is as dangerous as wishing for failure. And the point of the mention of the Bible verse is that it's almost better when there's a failure, because often when we're suffering a little, we are reminded, oh, hang on, the self doesn't suffer, this isn't truth, and you sort of bring ourselves back onto the path, if you will. So for example, it might be you know, get noticed that you don't get a job that you want, and momentarily you're upset, and then thanks to some of the practices you've been doing, perhaps you are reminded, oh, hang on, let me just observe that suffering, that the suffering of the mind, and what the mind is saying, and who is it that's failed, or who is it that didn't get the job, and maybe you sort of move back into more like being in the self. But when we're being successful, it's a whole different game, because we're not in the space to do the deep questioning. Often we're just like rolling along with it, and the mind's like, shh, really happy right now, don't do any deep digging, just ignore it. So it's as dangerous when we talk about success or strive for success as when we are experiencing as to sort of be averse to failure. The two are together. And then I love this idea of, you know, whether you go up the ladder or down it, your position is shaky. So essentially, the minute you're in the world of duality of success and failure and achieving and not achieving and desires and cravings and aversions, you're on a ladder that is propped up very vicariously, what's the word, precariously, against a wall. And whether you go up or down, it's still wobbling. It's only really if you stand with your 2 feet on the ground, like in your sense of self, in your being, that you will always keep your balance. So says this verse. So what does it mean that hope is as hollow as fear? And that's the next line. Hope is as hollow as fear. And it says, hope and fear are both phantoms that arise from thinking of the small self. So again, just like success and failure, hope is the opposite to fear, I guess, in this context, and they are empty. So again, we've used the word hollow, and we often think of fear as hollow. Again, you know, when we can feel our fear rise up, and sometimes we're able to sort of sit back in the being of in sort of self and in our being and say, well, fear is arising, but for who is fear arising? Or we can sense as we move back into that space of being that there is nothing to fear. But hope often it sort of comes with a cloak. It seems very harmless, perhaps, when we're hoping for something to happen. But again, we're in this sort of idea of if we sat back in the self, does the self need to hope? Is there anything to hope for? No, everything is just perfect as it is. There is no thought of future or past. There is only presence. So why would there be need for hope? But again, we can sort of get confused about these, you know, what the mind deems to be positive values, things like hope and success and joy versus sadness. Trying to think of some other opposites. So hope and fear are both phantoms that arise from thinking of the small self. So I love this idea that as we think of the small self as we sort of think with our identity. I know, so it would be, oh, Helen wants this and Helen wants that, and Helen's hoping that she, I don't know, makes a ton of money and gets to live in a big house, or Helen's hoping that she gets to her place on time. What's happening there is almost, it's like a ghost, it's a phantom, because it's not real. There's no reality in that statement, because who is Helen? Where is she? Where does she exist? What is this hope that she's hoping for, and why? And all the time you can have a sense that you're perceiving this, and therefore if you're perceiving, then that's not who you really are. Being able to sort of perceive, hang on, there's a thought coming through the mind that there is a hope for something happening, or there's a fear. Suddenly there's a, I see a fear arising about something in the future. And she also says, happiness is not something to achieve. It is our function. Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's nothing to achieve. Absolutely nothing to achieve. And so it says very clearly, when we don't see the self as self, what do we have to fear? So if we're not caught up in that sense of identity, sort of mistaken identity, as it were, then what is there to fear? Nothing, you know, if we sit back for a moment. In fact, let's do that. Let's just sit back for a moment. And just sort of seek that sense of being that is always there. We don't have to seek it, but, you know, sometimes it feels like we have to seek it out. But if we move into this place, it feels very spacious or empty, and there's not even a concept of fear. It doesn't exist. I mean, what is there possibly to be afraid of? So when we don't see the self as self, what do we have to fear? See the world as yourself, with a big S. Have faith in the way things are. Love the world as yourself. Then you can care for all things. I love these few lines. See the world as yourself. Have faith in the way things are. Love the world as yourself. Then you can care for all things. And this is very, you know, this is echoed throughout the Tao Te Ching, this idea of sort of understand, just being happy with whatever arises, and not necessarily being happy, just being okay with whatever arises, just observing whatever arises, just resting in the self. Because, you know, it's not necessarily our direct experience, and I can't say it's my direct experience that, or my experience that I look upon the world and I see the self. I don't. That would be untrue to say that. But that's what we're sort of aiming for, as it were. Or if that is our true nature, as it were. If we were resting in our true nature, everything we would see would be the self as well. Love the world as yourself, then you can care for all things. So I wanted to share, I was listening to a Muji satsang last weekend, or some point last week. I think it was last weekend. And there was a really, so what happens during Muji satsangs is he'll, if you're not familiar, he'll talk at length for a couple of hours, about something, taking questions from people. And people are very under the very strict instructions that they don't come with their problems. It's not, hey Jay, it's not a place where you come and say, you know, I'm having this problem in life. Why am I so depressed? You know, you leave all that at the door when you come into satsang with Muji, and you all the questions that arise are really just about this exploration of self-inquiry, and exploration of the self. And then in the second half, he has letters. You know, Muji receives lots of letters, and he asks that they be fairly succinct and again adhere to this this idea that we don't come with our problems. It's a place for real deep, deep introspection and self-inquiry. One of the letters he received was really interesting. It was from a guy, I think, who was saying that he was practicing the path of self-inquiry and was able to rest in the being, in self, and experience spaciousness and emptiness and harmoniousness, nothingness in that place. And what arose while he was in that state of meditation, I suppose, was a real deep love and compassion for humanity. And this very deep love and compassion for humanity prevented him from taking his sort of going even deeper in his inquiry, that something in there was like, no, you could be annihilated, and you are here to serve, because you have such love and compassion for humanity, and you need to be here in the world, offering this love and compassion to humanity and serving humanity. And so he asked, very sensibly, he said, "Is this the mind tricking me, or indeed, am I? Is this where it stops for me? Should I take heed that I'm having this sort of block?" Amuji's response was, very nuanced, as you can imagine. It's not the same path for everyone. So he was, clear to say that for some people, maybe that is, you get to a point where you can discern that actually that is consciousness wanting to have the experience of giving love and compassion, and so that stops with you for now. That could be it. But he also made this point that I thought was really interesting, and he said that humanity's not that great. Why do you want to have such love and compassion for them? What's that about? And which is kind of shocking to hear from a spiritual seeker, but incredibly refreshing to hear, because it's very true. Humanity does terrible, terrible things, and we all know this. So why would you focus so much on loving humanity? And he says, what it is, what happens when you take, if he was to take this meditation deeper and further in an inquiry, was that if he wasn't destined to leave his body, if that wasn't him done, and he was to abide in his true nature and self in the world, and act from there, that what actually is happening is you're loving the self in others. You have compassion for the self in others. And this kind of blew my mind, because so often we talk about having loving kindness and compassion for other human beings, or for the environment, for the planet, for animals. And here's sort of Muji saying, yeah, but that actually prevents you from going even deeper, because what the experience you really want to have is not to like cultivate love and compassion for everyone else. It's to cultivate love and compassion for the self, and that self is in everything in the world. So naturally, as an extension of loving the self, you love everything. And this is kind of what these few lines in the Tao are saying. See the world as yourself, have faith in the way things are, love the world as yourself, and then you can care for all things. I thought that was really, really interesting. I'm overcome with sadness about the way animals are treated. Hello, welcome. It's often overcome with the way the planet is treated. And sometimes that can actually sort of shift you into a state of the identity, back into this. Well, I can do something, and I am the doer, and I will save the world. I will look after all the animals, or why is everyone so mean? And the judgments are created. But instead, what these teachings of Muji and the Tao sort of say is just sort of come back to the self and just let all that go, and just have faith that when you practice these practices of moving into being, that your love will extend from that for everything. So you don't have to worry about being a bad person. Once you move into a state of experience, of your natural state of being all the time, you're not gonna be cruel to animals and not care about them or not love humanity. And I read a similar thing recently. I mentioned this last week. I read a few weeks ago The Chasm of Fire, which is Irina Tweedie's journal of her time with a guru, a Sufi guru in India. I think it was around the 60s that she was there. Some time ago, and she passed away, I think in the 90s. I know in the 90s, I'm not sure when in the 90s. But anyway, she has this, as she's studying with her guru, if you can imagine, she's in India and the weather is really dramatic. So she suffers a lot, she's in sort of bare bones accommodation. She gives all her money to this guru. There's these incredibly hot winds that last for months that just bring dust in. The weather's very oppressive and hot, and she really sort of struggles, and the smells are terrible. And there are these moments in her time with this guru that nature really blossoms for her, and it's such a joy to her. There's like a tree outside her window that once a year blossoms, and it brings her great joy. There's a few sunsets that are pink and orange that really touch her heart. And she often is able to walk with her friend her teacher, the guru, through by the river at night. And she comments on this. It's quite a long way into her sort of studying with him. She comments on, how beautiful nature is and blah, blah, blah. And he shuts her down and he says, why do you do that? Why do you put nature up beyond God? Why do you worship nature? You love nature more than you love God. You're a terrible disciple. Go away, kind of thing. And she's really shocked. She's really shocked. And he sort of does this to her. He's helping her break down her personality, and she's very grateful, and they have a beautiful, very loving relationship. But it's kind of a shock to her, and it was kind of a shock when I read it. But it sort of speaks to this same point. And again, I'm not familiar with teachings of the Bible, but it kind of reminds me of this idea of not creating, like not worshipping false idols. And it's so strange to think of the world, the planet, animals, plants, the environment, humanity, children as idols. Because we feel like, of course, we should be looking after all these things, and maybe that's just our true nature, like knocking on us. Yes, that's what you'd be doing in your true nature, but we often end up putting these things above our love for God. And so, what this guru was telling her that she understood was that she just should be focusing on the self in everything, or if you want to say God in everything, or the divine in everything. And that can seem so esoteric and woolly. What does that mean? I look at my dog. I try and focus on seeing, the divinity in her. But it's very hard. This is sort of a bit of an esoteric practice, not always achievable. In fact, I've never achieved it. I might love my dog with my whole heart. And sometimes I think she's my guru. But I've never sort of managed to see God in my dog. But what Muji is saying is to practice that, it's just going in, it's going into the self, it's abiding in self. And it's just sort of constantly, if you're following an Advaita Vedanta path, just asking, well, who is it that loves humanity? Who is it that wants to be compassionate? And maybe you get a sense of that, or who's perceiving the thought that I need to stop my meditation, for example, because of my love for humanity. There's a perceiver behind that because you can hear it, you can sense it. So therefore, that's not who you are either. So then you come back to who am I? And then coming back deeper and deeper into this sense of self with a capital S. So I thought that was really interesting, and it kind of, I don't know if any of you are into yoga, but it's essentially the meaning of namaste. which we kind of oversay in a yoga class. But it really means, like the self in me bows to the self in you. It's very easy to say, oh, namaste, namaste. But actually, when you think about the essence, it's what it's saying. It's saying that, there's an acknowledgement that the self in me is that in you. And Muji says that there really is nothing more joyful to consciousness than loving, experiencing itself as consciousness, falling in love with itself. Which I just think is just so beautiful and kind of explains that really blissed out feeling when you're in that space. So I thought that was really beautiful. And just to think about with these few lines in this verse. And there was a slightly different translation by Wayne Dyer. And then another translation. So I just thought I'd read them and maybe just explore some of the differences or nuances around that. So Wayne Dyer's translation of this verse is, favor and disgrace seem alarming. High status greatly afflicts your person. That's a bit drier. Why are favor and disgrace alarming? Seeking favor is degrading, alarming when it is gotten, alarming when it is lost. And then he goes on, why does high status greatly afflict your person? The reason we have a lot of trouble is that we have selves with a small s. If we had no selves, what trouble would we have? And again, this idea of all of our suffering comes from this identity with ourselves as the body, as the person, as the emotions, as the thoughts, instead of sitting back and abiding in self or accessing our true nature or just sitting in that. And it says, man's true self is eternal, yet he thinks, I am this body and will soon die. If we have no body, what calamities can we have? One who sees himself as everything is fit to be guardian of the world, and one who loves himself as everyone is fit to be teacher of the world. So what I thought was interesting about this particular translation was that it's very clear that man's true self is eternal, yet he thinks, I am this body and will soon die, which we do. And I was listening to or catching up with Regina's Guiding Light discussion. Just today, and as I said, she's working through Sri Ramana Maharshi's the spiritual teachings of Sri Ramana Maharshi. And in the first page, it mentions that, I'm not the body. I'm not the body. And it's so interesting that even when we are sat, and I was sort of meditating this week and doing some self-inquiry, that even when there's a sense of spaciousness and emptiness, and I can feel it into the perceiver. There is still a feeling that the perceiver is encased in some way or connected to, in some way, the body. So it feels, while it can feel sort of outside of the body and spacious, there is this sense that the hands are still its, or the legs are still its, and the heart that's beating. And one of the things that I've struggled with lately in sitting meditation, this has actually been a while, is that I get to a place where the heart starts to beat really fast and I don't breathe. Or there is a thought that arises or notices that I might not be breathing, or it's sort of hard to explain, but it's like a sense of real tightness around the throat and chest as if I'm not breathing. And there's a fear that arises that if I go deeper, I won't breathe. I'll just like pass out or something. And so I try, my mind tries to trick me by saying things like, well, does it matter? Just take a breath. You can carry on with your meditation then. Just take a deep breath and move on. But every time I noticed that I was taking a breath, I was putting myself back into, associating myself with the body, or identifying myself with the body, and it would knock me out of going like, deeper into this, who am I, and whereas who's the perceiver? So the other day, I decided instead what I might do is because I have an intellectual understanding that I am not the body. Perhaps we all, if we're on this path, we can say, oh, yeah, no, I'm not the body, I'm the self. Yeah, I get it. But actually, when you sit down to meditate and you're not breathing, all of a sudden you feel very, very much like you're the body. And you really care for the body at that moment. And you don't really understand that the body breathes all by itself. Even though you go, yes, I know the body breathes by itself, it's breathing while I'm asleep, for God's sake. So I don't need to get involved. The mind is sort of screaming, no breath, no life. So what I did was I just tried to be like very compassionate with that thought for a start and not fight it too much, but just gently ask, gently perceive the tightness of the breath, and then ask myself, well, if I'm perceiver, then I'm not the tightness of the breath. And when the thought arose, you've got to take a breath. Just moving back to, I can perceive, I'm aware that there is a thought telling me I need to take a breath. And sort of having this trust, as it says, like having faith in the way things are, that my body will breathe if it needs to breathe. I don't need to do that for it. So it begin to What happened for me was it began to break this connection of the mind and the body, which often breath work does actually. But I began to see that the mind, the body will do what it's going to do. The body's going to breathe or it's not going to breathe. The mind likes to think it controls that, but essentially, with the breath, the beauty of the breath is that we can control the breath. We can take a breath in, we can take a breath out. But we also don't need to control the breath. The breath just moves on its own. So it's a really interesting, so when you play with breath work, particularly in yoga, for example, you can begin to see that there is this belief that we fall into, that the mind controls the body, when in fact you see through the breath that the body is just doing its own thing. And then you sort of, ask yourself, well, the body's doing its own thing. What is Who's doing that? Who's the doer of the body? Like, I know it's not the mind. So who is it? And you begin to sort of get touch this sense of that there is doing happening. And it sort of allows you the space just to move back into self. So anyway, it was a really sort of interesting experience. And I kind of just trusted that the more I explore it, or the more I just sort of try and sit back and perceive it and just be aware of it, that over time it will fade, and it really has. Just in a few days, that experience, which has been around for, I'd say a year, and I haven't really known what to do with it, has really begun to sort of move through. So I'm able to go deeper, and I thought it was like a parallel with what the questioner Muji was asking. For him, it was loving compassion, and one of the things I love about Muji, he was saying, the mind will come at you wherever the weakest link is. It will hit you there. And so if the mind really loves loving being compassionate, if the mind really loves to feel like kind to animals and stuff, it's going to come at you there during your meditation practice. You're going to hear that. Or if the mind really loves being successful at work, it's going to start talking to you about the things you're not doing while you're sat there meditating. Or if you have a lot of guilt, it's going to come at you with, why aren't you walking your dog or being with your children right now? So they all find a way. I know when I went to do Vipassana, for example, which is like a 10-day silent meditation retreat, the second day you have the option to stay in your room to meditate from 4:30 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. and then later in the afternoon. So the second day, I was really tired in the afternoon and I could feel that I was, falling asleep. And I thought, what would be lovelier than just, I'll go to my room instead of sitting in the meditation hall with everyone, because we're allowed, and we'll make like a real nice nest for myself and prop myself up and open a window to keep myself awake. That's what I'll do. I won't sit in the hall, with the mind. So I sat down, and I fell straight asleep. And I woke up 2 hours later, and I'd missed a whole session of meditation. And I felt, I just wanted to kick myself. You only get 10 days there, and I've missed these couple of hours of practicing this technique, and that they move you through a technique quite fast at the beginning. So I thought, well, I'm never doing that again. I'm never doing that again. So I just made sure that I got up in the morning and I sat in that hall, and I left for breaks, but otherwise I sat in the hall for pretty much 14 hours of a day. Maybe, yeah, 14 hours of a day, with a couple of hours of break on top. And you know, I was thinking about this because often people will say, "Oh, I can't meditate because I fall asleep," and it's really just a mind's distraction. It's no different to a thought arising in your mind that says, "You know, you need to. Why aren't you at work?" Or, "You know, you've got to do this tonight." Or it's no different to a dead leg. Really, they are just there. The mind will find a way of creating these distractions so that you can't go deeper. But the beauty of a practice of where you just sit behind that and perceive it is that you don't have to follow that thought. And then intellectually, you know, you can sort of begin to understand, well, hang on a minute. When I'm going on vacation, I have 4 hours sleep, perhaps. You know, I fall asleep at midnight because I'm so excited, and I get up at 4 a.m. because I've got to get to the airport, and I have a whole day of traveling, and then I get to my vacation spot and party all night, and I don't fall asleep. So I guess I can go without sleeping for 20 minutes today. And then slowly that sort of realization comes in a bit deeper, beyond sort of this intellectual understanding that it's just the mind working with distractions to move us. But I love this way of sort of noticing what arises to distract us from doing the deep dive when we sat there, and then recognizing that it's possibly our weakest link is using whatever possible. And we might notice, you know, themes that arise with each of us. Mine is generally just like a itchy feeling that I need to, you know, it's like, oh, the dog's not happy, I should go and let her out. Oh, the dog should come in, and oh, the dog looks too hot, I'll go and put the AC on for it's like this constant with the dog. So there, what time? Yeah, it's 1:45. I thought I would just read a couple of I wanted to read you something from Muji. It was interesting, and then there's a nice poem from Thomas Merton, The Way of Changzu, that deals, you know, that's similar to the Tao Te Ching, that I thought I could read, and then we'll have some music. But before I go on, does anyone want to share anything at all, and about their own practice perhaps, or some of the distractions or challenges of really sort of feeling residing in the self? Jay says he's driving. You had a question earlier on the board. Sorry, Cheryl. Do you think, there it is, do you think going beyond form is only achieved through this body? I don't know if I understand it. Do you think going beyond form is only achieved through this body in the mind? Are you saying you think it's only a human experience? Is that what you're saying? That you have to be in a human body to move beyond form? Is that what you're saying? Not sure, I'm only human. Okay. Bye, Jay. Yeah, I don't know, I have to ponder on that one. I'm not sure I'm really getting it. And I'm nervous to drop the mic because whenever I drop the mic, it takes me 5 minutes to be able to hear anyone else. So I'm going to ponder on that. If you can phrase it a different way, feel free to do that, Cheryl, and I'll come back to it. But in the meantime, I'm just going to read this piece from Muji. Okay. So he's talking about why don't we just abide in self all the time? Why don't we do that? Why don't we just, as the Tao Te Ching says, don't have anything to fear when you're there. You'll love everyone. You'll be all the things you always wanted to be. Just abide in the self. Don't get caught up in this identity of yourself as a person and a mind and a body and thoughts. And when we sit in silence and move into that place, generally we'll agree that it's very peaceful, it's very pleasant. But yet we still choose to come out of it. We choose to go and have an ice cream and go and have all these experiences and climb up a mountain and we have this like bucket list of our life that these experiences that we want to do or that consciousness perhaps wants to experience. So why don't we just rest in self? And it's because we're putting more value on something else and that eventually changes over time. But there's a lovely story that sort of that shows this. It's called The Fisherwoman and the Florist. Some fisherwomen were accustomed to walking through a forest to get to the sea. There they would wait for the fishermen to come back with the catch. Then the women would put all the fish into baskets and carry them back on their heads to the village to sell. One day, three women had collected all the fish and were returning to the village through the forest when suddenly the monsoon arrived with a bang, much like this evening, if you're experiencing it. Lightning was flashing, rain was pouring down, and with strong winds blowing, they were afraid of falling coconuts. On the way through the forest, in this state of panic, they passed by a small house. It was the home of a florist, which also served as her flower shop. When the florist saw the fisherwoman coming, she called out, "Come, come, take shelter in my home." Quickly, they ran to the florist's house. She said, "You simply cannot go on in the storm. It would be too dangerous. Please spend the night here. The fish will stay fresh outside in the wet air." They gladly accepted the invitation and set their fish down on the veranda in their baskets. The florist showed them into a room that was full of flowers, lavender, jasmine, beautiful roses, and so on. "Stay here tonight. You'll be fine," she said. Like this, they all lay down, but none of them could sleep. One of them was very restless and kept fidgeting. "What's wrong?" asked the eldest fisherwoman. "I can't sleep," she said. "It smells horrible in here." "I can't sleep either," said the other, "with the stink of these flowers in my nostrils." "Well, what should we do?" So the elder one said, "I know what we can do." She crept out onto the veranda, got one of the fish baskets, held it out in the rain, shook it a bit, and brought it inside. Now at last, all of them fell asleep and slept like babies because they were accustomed to the smell of fish. Emoji says, "Fish gave these fisherwomen a comfortable feeling. The fragrance of roses and jasmine and lavender was horrible to them. They couldn't enjoy the flowers. And so it is with us. It's almost as though we have to reacquire the taste for our own higher nature. This is why most people at most times in their lives are on kind of a slow cook setting on their spiritual path. Being completely identified with their personality, they would find it unbearable if suddenly their identity were to be dissolved in pure consciousness." I think that's so interesting. And I've been sort of trying to bump up my practice, if you will, the last few weeks of just noticing when their mind starts to kick in or. And I'd say it was easier with some suffering than to do that than it is when I'm enjoying life, should we say? So and I notice that sometimes it's very hard. I mean, it's so simple. You just move back into being. You just ask, who is experiencing this agitation? Can the self get agitated? Who's perceiving this agitation? If you sit in traffic, getting madder at people, as I often am in Brooklyn. Sometimes something so simple, the mind just is like, "Oh God, I just don't want to do it. I just don't want to rest in that peace." And yet I've experienced it as peace. But I notice the more I do it, the more familiar it feels, and the more my mind then says, "Ah," or maybe it's not my mind. I don't know. the more it's okay for it to happen, the more space there is for me to go back and sit in that place. Of the flowers rather than the smelly fish. Okay, so I'm just going to read this short poem. Oh, it's about fishes as well, isn't it? That's interesting. I guess that's how it happens when you don't prepare. Things just line up. I'm going to read this. So again, this is the way of Chang Tzu, who was a teacher like Lao Tzu. This is a translation by Thomas Merton of some of his poetry. So it's a bit more flowery than Lao Tzu. Man is born in Tao. Fishes are born in water. Man is born in Tao. If fishes born in water seek the deep shadow of pond and pool, all their needs are satisfied. If man born in Tao sinks into the deep shadow of non-action to forget aggression and concern, he lacks nothing. His life is secure. So when we're talking about Tao here, we're talking about that deep sense of being. The moral: all the fish needs is to get lost in water, and all man needs is to get lost in Tao. I love that. So simple. We're just like fish in water, and we just need to sink into the water that we're already in. Okay, so I'm going to just wrap up for the evening with a song. I think I'll do this one as we were talking about loving the world. It's called I Love You by the Hanumen. Okay. Here we go. If it gets too loud, just type in the room and I'll turn it down.
Father, I want you to know that I love you. Children, I want you to know that I love you. I love you. Children, I want you to know that I love you. I love you. There may have been things that I've done to make you doubt.
I love that song. It goes on and on. God, I love you. Buddha, I love you. Krishna, I love you. Jesus, I love you. It's very sweet. And I believe Sita Ram means love is all there is. Certainly, that's how I used it as a mantra. So, thanks for joining me this evening. I hope you all have a lovely week and look forward to spending time with you next week. So thank you very much. And thank you, Cheryl. Over to you.